Hello, and welcome to The P-Value, a podcast about science, philosophy, and everything in between. The P-Value is an initiative of the Centre for Philosophy of the Sciences at the Australian National University.
Imagine this. You go to the doctor for a checkup, and they ask you to go for a fasting blood glucose test to check you don't have diabetes. You do the test, and a week or so later you get a call asking you to come in for the results. Your fasting blood glucose test indicates you have prediabetes. In other words, your blood test shows your body isn't processing sugar as well as it should be. "Don't worry," says your doctor. "Your blood sugar levels are higher than they should be, but they're not yet deemed high enough for diagnosis with type 2 diabetes. With some lifestyle changes, you should be able to reverse the situation," they say. Interestingly, pre-1997, there was no such thing as prediabetes. Well, at least not as a diagnosis. The standard diagnosis arose from a recommendation by the American Diabetes Association in that year, intending to pick out those at higher risk of developing type 2 diabetes, but who do not yet have symptoms and don't satisfy the criteria for the disease itself. Prediabetes diagnosis is controversial. Indeed, a 2014 paper in the prestigious British Medical Journal argued that a prediabetes diagnosis offered little benefit to individuals and carried huge individual and societal level medical and social costs. This is because, said the authors, the category is so broadly defined that many of those satisfying the criteria for prediabetes aren't actually destined to end up with the full-blown type 2 diabetes even without intervention. Yet the diagnosis carries with it loads of costs and harms to the individual, potentially without benefit. What's really needed, they argue, is a public health strategy to tackle obesity and inactivity in the population, as these are the real driving force of the increasing number of cases of type 2 diabetes. This debate about whether prediabetes should not be a real diagnosis might surprise you. It's tempting to think questions of health and disease are answerable by relatively mind-independent facts. In short, there's just some fact of the matter, whether you're unwell or diseased or not. Things are not so straightforward, however. To return to diabetes, the diagnostic criteria for prediabetes, gestational diabetes, and type 2 diabetes have all varied over time, and there's considerable disagreement within the medical fraternity about exactly where blood sugar level cutoffs for these different diagnoses should be. Too liberal, and you impose costs on people that are unwarranted. Too strict, and you risk underdiagnosis and harm by failing to adequately provide care when it's needed. Ultimately, what's required is a clear account of what it is to be healthy and unhealthy, or diseased. But such an account is less easy to come by than you might think. And that is the topic of today's episode of The P-Value. Welcome. Today in The P-Value, I'll be talking about disease. What makes something a disease? Is it a matter of biology or social context or a bit of both? When we go to the doctor and he diagnosed with a disease, what exactly are we being told? It's tempting to think it's just a matter of suffering. Disease is just an instance of human suffering. But alas, that's too permissive as a definition for disease. There are loads of incidents of human suffering, even those that might require treatment by a doctor, that don't seem appropriately defined as a disease. Childbirth, for example, involves significant suffering in the birthing parent, but it would be really counterintuitive to say it was an instance of disease. Similarly, surgical incisions or vaccinations and even ear piercing all involve instances of human suffering, but none look quite right to be categorised as disease states. Suffering also seems to be context-dependent. A same-sex attracted person living in a systematically homophobic state would be reasonably said to be suffering, and severely so. But it would be a mistake to therefore infer that their sexual attraction was a disease. I point to this case because the history of same-sex attraction being seen as a mental disease or a case of mental defectiveness is significant in this debate and something that those seeking to define disease want to ensure can't be perpetuated. It's for these reasons that theorists have looked to further criteria beyond mere suffering or harm to help narrow down our definition of disease and thereby our definition of health. We want to exclude the sort of cases I've just described, but still include all those cases we think merit statuses of disease. Asthma, eczema, the flu, all of those things we want to count. But we don't want to count the things like childbirth. One approach made famous by Christopher Bourse in the 1970s, the biostatistical approach, seeks to do away with questions regarding harm altogether. Indeed, Bourse focuses on giving a definition of what is normal and abnormal. That, it is claimed, is the only route to a truly objective and properly naturalistic or biological account of disease. According to Bourse's account, a disease or pathological condition occurs when an internal state impairs the ability of a person to function normally, when normal function refers to the activity of parts of the body or processes in the statistically typical manner to individual survival and reproduction. Here, statistically typical manner relates to a particular reference class, such as age or group or sex of a species. This is a mouthful, but the idea is relatively simple. It points out that for a natural grouping of humans by age or sex or mixture of the two, we can establish what's typical in terms of their bodily functions. This is normal function or health, and deviation from it is dysfunction or disease. For example, we might say that a person has heart disease if their heart isn't pumping blood within what we consider to be the statistically typical range for someone of their age and sex. Similarly, a digestive system might be considered to have diabetes when it can no longer process sugars within the bounds of what we consider the statistically typical manner for someone of a particular age and sex. Bourse's approach has the advantage of avoiding some of the problem cases raised earlier. Something like childbirth is not a disease for Bourse, even though it involves suffering in the birth parent, because it's part of the normal functioning of the body of a pregnant person. Similarly, Bourse gives us tools to appropriately categorise same-sex attraction as not disease or pathology. As mentioned before, same-sex attraction has historically been deemed a mental illness or disease, being within the DSM or Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders in some form or another, right until the publication of DSM-5 in 2013. As Bourse points out, though, same-sex attraction falls into the statistically typical functioning of bodies and so is not pathological, even if it's extremely harmful to individuals under certain homophobic social contexts. We'll turn to some challenges to Bourse's accounts next. One major challenge for Bourse's biostatistical account is determining what counts as normal functioning, and thus, what can be considered a dysfunction. Some are sceptical that this can really be done in any principled manner. To quote one sceptic, philosopher of biology Ron Amundsen, "The partitioning of human variation into the normal versus the abnormal has no firmer footing than the partitioning into races. Diversity of function is a fact of biology." Essentially, he's saying that there's no way to give a mind-independent or objective distinction between cases of apparent disease or dysfunction and simple, natural, expected phenotypic variation. Consider, for example, something like acne. We take acne to be a normal part of adolescence and puberty, but there's still a point at which it's deemed appropriate to seek medical help and perhaps treatment for it. The question is, however, is there any point at which severe acne becomes a disease? Or is it better understood as an extreme example of natural human variation? Similarly, to return to heart disease and diabetes, at what point do we deem a cutoff between normal variation in typical function and dysfunction? How poorly must a heart pump blood to count as not normal? How high a blood sugar is too high? There are two moves open to naturalists here. One is to try and give a more principled account of dysfunction. Andrew Wakefield, for example, famously draws on natural selection and the idea of selected function to ground dysfunction. Another is to add complexity and a further criteria to the definition of disease. We'll get to this shortly. But before that, there's another worry some raise for Bourse's approach we should discuss. Specifically, critics argue that it doesn't appear to track the practice of scientists and medical doctors. Again, same-sex attraction is a key case. Same-sex attraction wasn't, Bourse's critics argue, removed from the DSM because of some sort of change in our medical knowledge of homosexuality, or change in our understanding of the statistical typical functioning of bodies. It was taken out of the DSM because of changes in society concerning values. This, it is said, suggests that there's some important role for values in judgments of disease and pathology. For Bourse, this is just a mistake. Homosexuality was never a disease in the first place. It was incorrectly categorised because of the poor application of the category of disease, not because disease itself is value-laden. This raises a question about how we should think of any definition of disease and its relation to practice. Should it capture all of the typical practice by doctors, all of our intuitive ideas of disease, or should it be at least somewhat revisionary? On one common contemporary naturalistic view, this can be dealt with by making disease classification a two-step process. First, we consider if the behaviour or process in question involves a malfunction or deviation from normal functioning, and then we consider whether it's harmful. If it is both these things, it's a disease. This allows us to rule out some cases of human suffering we don't want to include as diseases, such as childbirth. It also allows for the potential of something being harmful or bad for a person in one context but not in another. Consider, for example, a person with mild anxiety that only manifests in harm or suffering in extremely stressful contexts. We can claim that a person in that situation does not have a disease unless stressful contexts are chronically present. While this sort of two-step naturalistic view gets us out of some challenges, we might still argue that harm is an inherently normative notion. Is there some purely objective account of it available? Furthermore, we might say that values are not only inherent in our definitions of harm, but also in causing what's harmful in the first place. Here, I'm pointing to a very different approach to disease, the constructivist approach. Social constructivists say there is no natural, objectively definable set of human malfunctions which cause disease. Rather, when we assert that something is a disease, we're making a judgment about the person undergoing a specific type of harm that we explain in terms of bodily processes. There is, they say, no sense in which these bodily processes are actually objectively malfunctioning. Rather, they're judged by us to be unusual or abnormal because of cultural and social concepts of human nature. In short, on this view, the idea of normal human is socially constructed. There is no naturalistic or scientifically respectable notion of it, and thus we can't ground our notion of disease in it. Rather, we must focus on harm. Then, given the challenges outlined at the start, what counts as a disease becomes a matter of both context, a state may be harmful in one society and not another, and our cultural notices. Then, given the challenges outlined at the start, what counts as a disease becomes a matter of both context, a state may be harmful in one society and not another, and also our cultural notions of normalcy. This sort of approach seems to capture well cases such as homosexuality. It was in the past considered an abnormal behaviour outside of human nature and thus a disease. As our notions of human nature have changed, so too has the status of homosexuality. Importantly, this change is not based in biological facts but values, human nature and thus disease being a social construct. The challenge for this approach is that it seems too disconnected from biology and unable to deal with many borderline cases. A person that commits a murder, for example, might reasonably be considered to be engaging in behaviour that goes against human nature as a social kind, but it seems a mistake to say they have a disease. Conversely, while this view can account for why same-sex attraction was in the past viewed as a disease, it doesn't seem to give us grounds to say that this was objectively a mistake. This is something that's super important. Again, we seem to have a problem of a criteria that's overly arbitrary and can't do all the work that we want. Neither the constructivist nor the biostatistical view nor the two-step naturalist view are without their problems. They fail in some cases. The real question you have to ask yourself is which view do you prefer and why?